Welcome to Teaching for Student Success. I'm Stephen Robineau. I have a question for our listeners. Who were your role models growing up? In particular, who were your role models that led you to your career in academia? I'm going to guess that most of your academic role models were teachers who look like you or might have similar backgrounds to you. Think about the power of that. Seeing an inspirational teacher, educator, thinker, academic, researcher that's like you in one way or another. If this happened to you, take a moment. Try to remember how inspirational that was. Now, imagine your first day in class after graduating high school. Imagine you find yourself in an academic environment in which you don't look like or sound like your professors. Imagine you had no cultural connection to the faculty you saw on campus or online every day. Imagine the unspoken message this might send. Imagine feeling like a stranger in a strange land. They don't look like me. I don't look like them. I don't belong here. Now think about the students in your classes. How many of them look or sound like you? How many share your cultural identity? Can you be their role model? Can you help your students see themselves as colleagues in your world? Today, I will have a conversation with Jeff Shinsky, professor of biology at Foothill College, part of the California Community College System. Jeff has degrees in the biological sciences and in music performance. As a Chicago Cubs fan, I can only assume that Jeff is an eternal optimist. although his optimism was rewarded in 2016 when the Chicago Cubs won its second World Series championship after a 108-year wait. Congratulations on that, Jeff.
Oh my gosh, don't remind me. Well, remind me of 2016. That was a good year. That was a good
2016
year.
Was a good year.
And yeah, that was a good one.
I saw a Cubs game in 2018. I was at a Cubs game in 2018. And after the game, we went and bought luggage tags for our luggage. And we put these luggage tags on, and they buckled on securely. They weren't going anywhere. When we got our luggage at the other end, one tag was missing. Somebody wanted a Chicago Cubs luggage tag.
Oh my gosh, you found the one other person who wants a Chicago Cubs.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Jeff is an accomplished educator. In 2018, he received the Outstanding Undergraduate Science Teaching Award from the Society for College Science Teachers, a national award. He has published extensively on education research, and he currently serves as the principal investigator and co-director of the National Institutes of Health-funded Scientist Spotlights Initiative. The Scientist Spotlights Initiative empowers educators at all levels to implement inclusive curricula that help all students see themselves in science. It provides access to easy-to-implement assignments that link course content to the stories of counter-stereotypical scientists. Welcome, Jeff. Thank you for joining us on Teaching for Student Success.
Thank you so much. This is super exciting. So great to chat with you.
Yeah, I'm excited too. So I just gave a very brief overview of the Scientist Spotlights Initiative. Could you please tell us about this initiative? Perhaps we should start with the purpose and then the problem you're trying to address.
Yeah, I think as I was listening to the introduction you provided there, lots really resonated with me that speaks to the purpose or speaks to the background. And so that might be a great place to start. In fact, some of the very questions that you were asking people to reflect on are very similar to the ones that I was reflecting on myself. And actually the ones that when I do workshops and talks now, I ask people to reflect on in thinking about this work. Beginning, especially when I was beginning as a full-time tenure-track professor 14, 15 years ago now, I was simultaneously getting really fascinated by the importance and the significance of the social science and education research literature that informs teaching. And one of the things back then that I was getting especially interested in was a stereotype threat, and that led me into many other realms of related to identity and stereotypes and possible selves and belonging. And so I just found all that literature really compelling. And, you know, reading Claude Steele's initial work on stereotype threat that is just really, again, really compelling and really indicating that even the subtle messages we send about who belongs in a particular field or who belongs in an environment and the messaging that we provide around that is really impactful in so many important ways, certainly in emotional ways and thinking about belonging and sense of community in the classroom. But if that weren't enough, even just for learning. And so like if we care about our fields, if I love biology and I care about biology and I want students to learn about biology, then a central component of that is that those students feel like their identities are honored in this field, in what we're studying. That is not just important for sort of the emotional health of the students, but it's important for them for learning mitosis. It's important for them for learning about muscle physiology, that those things are enhanced very directly with large impacts based on the sense of belonging and sense of identity safety that those students have in that room. Again, I just found it really compelling, and it really got me thinking and reflecting. And one of the first things I started reflecting on was, again, very similar to the questions that you were posing. And I really left it for my own classroom or put it in my own classroom, thinking about, okay, I buy it. Like, I buy this literature. This messaging is important. So in my own classroom, what examples of scientists do my students encounter as part of my curricula, as part of my classwork, as part of what they do for homework and in class? What examples of scientists might they encounter? And then importantly, what messages might those scientists be sending in terms of who they represented and what I was implicitly telling students about my field based on those examples? Strikingly, I actually got stuck at the first question, the first one, which was, what examples of scientists was I featuring? And my somewhat humble and sobering answer was none. In my field of teaching in anatomy and physiology, it's just not often discussed. I think maybe it's a little bit more in some general biology fields and other places, but it's just really not part of the curriculum at all, at least mine. I'll take it on myself. It was not part of my curriculum in anatomy and physiology to be featuring scientists and who scientists were, except perhaps for one example, which is of course me. I very much am a scientist, and I think I present myself as a scientist and I identify as a scientist and I love science. And so really the one example was myself in that classroom. And frankly, that gave me quite a lot of pause, because here I was looking around my just amazing students. I'm so fortunate to have, you know, maybe the best job in the world, working with the most amazing students in the world. But none of them really have my same set of identities. I'm very aware that I am a white, heterosexual, cisgender man. Further, I'm not a veteran. I'm not a first generation student. So when I look at my students, some of them have some of those identities, but it's fair to say almost none of them, or maybe none of them, have all of those same identities. And thinking back to the literature I was reading, I was just worried, like, oh my gosh, this one example of a scientist in my classroom, me, may actually not be a helpful one, or frankly, might be a harmful one. And to this day, it's given me a lot of pause about my positionality in my position, in my work, and whether I'm even the right person to be teaching community college biology. And that's a question I have to this day, and I'm not sure I'll ever have an answer to that. But that led to, I think, that some of the work that we're talking about here in the Scientist Spotlights Initiative to try to change that dynamic and to try to shift it so that when I answer that question for myself in the future, my answer is not none or only me in terms of who are the people who are scientists who are featured in this classroom, that it would not just be no people or not just be only me. So maybe I'll start there because I've talked a lot, but I think that again, when you're talking about your intro, it really just resonated with me in terms of some of the exact same questions I was reflecting on as an early tenure track professor.
Great. Thank you. So I want to come back. Don't let me forget to ask this question later. Are you the right person to be in front of the classroom? That's a really interesting question. I think the answer, I want the answer to be yes. And I want the answer after we talk about your Scientist Spotlights Initiative. I want to know, after we talk about it and after you think about that, of course, you've thought about it a lot.
Yeah.
Don't you feel that that puts you in a better position to answer that question as yes? But don't answer that now. Let's come back to that.
All right.
So let's talk about how this initiative is implemented. How does it work? How do faculty participate? What is it? What is this initiative?
Yeah. So I can take you a little bit historically through that as well, because one of the things that was serendipitous about the same time where I was having these these sort of professional identity crises myself about my positioning in the classroom was that a colleague who's actually a sociologist, interestingly, a sociology colleague said, "Hey, have you ever heard of this podcast called Story Collider?" And I said, "Well, no, I have not." And she said, "Well, you should really check it out because it's really fascinating. They have hundreds, if not more, thousands, I don't know, of podcasts of stories from scientists that are mostly autobiographical, of course, because we talk about ourselves when we tell us stories usually. And they're all from scientists and they all relate to science in some way." And I said, "Well, I should check that out. That sounds interesting." And I was immediately hooked. I thought it was fascinating and really fun to listen to. And so I thought, hey, you know, this would be fun to give to my students just for a weekly homework assignment. Because I think that I picked one that I thought was kind of funny and poignant and touching in various ways, and made it a homework assignment with a very open reflection of just like, hey, you know, what was most interesting? What was most confusing? What questions did this bring up for you? Just very open reflection. What seemed like it was done sort of on a whim turned out to be really quite life-changing in terms of my career, I think, because the responses I got back were so beyond what I anticipated and so compelling. Students writing far beyond the word count, students asking for more homework like this, students making connections on so many deep levels that I never anticipated, students saying that this is the first time that they've ever encountered a scientist that they can relate to and that seems like them, and how transformative it was for them just to listen to that podcast. Wow. It really made me step back and say, okay, hold on. Something's going on here. I've been missing something for a long time. There's something that my students are calling for, desperate for, and needing. And I need to figure this out, and I need to do more about it. That over many iterations, and so that was back in probably, I don't know, 2014 or something around there. Now, over many iterations, getting close to a decade now, it's really evolved into what is the Scientist Spotlight assignment. And it typically is done as a homework assignment still by most folks. But they involve a scientist that it is somehow revealing counter-stereotypical features of themselves. And so there's lots of things that can be counter-stereotypical. But it's often based on a story like that, like a Story Collider podcast or an interview that they've done or a biographical essay that they've written. But there's some sort of biographical piece that students would access and either listen to, watch, read, or somehow experience as part of a Scientist Spotlight assignment. And of course, we try to be very purposeful about the types of resources we feature there so that they're hopefully compelling and interesting and engaging. Then, importantly, there's also something related to that scientist's work that students would access. And so this could be an excerpt, usually not a whole thing, but maybe an excerpt from one of their primary literature articles, so a peer-reviewed paper that the scientist wrote. Or it could be a YouTube video that's not even by that scientist, but is about what they study. And so, you know, if there's somebody who studies bone physiology or something, it could be a YouTube video that just shows how some of the bone cells work or what the bone cells are. So it doesn't necessarily have to be something that is primary literature, though it's a lovely opportunity to bring primary literature into the classroom. So those two resources, typically the biographical one, the scientific one, are what are accessed by the students. The scientific one is almost always, and I would hope, connected to the content that's being studied in class, such that this is actually assisting and promoting content coverage and helps with content-related goals. And there's some specific reasons for that as well. We want these to really be connected to the curricula and not feel like extra things. It's important to us that these assignments not feel very different from the class. We don't want the scientist featured to be sort of tokenized in some way where, oh, you know, we're doing our classwork over here and now like time out. Now we're going to do the scientist spotlight that is looking at the scientist that seems totally different from what we're doing in class. And okay, now time back in, we're going back to our content. We think that that's not necessarily the best approach or way to initiate change and in the classroom and in higher education. So we really want the curricula to be central to these. The students would somehow experience something about the scientist's work, something about the scientist's biography, and then write a reflective essay that relates to that, where students are thinking about what they learned from those resources, what questions they have. And we always include the very explicit question, what did this assignment tell you about the types of people that do science? Students are welcomed to, they're not required to answer that question, but they're welcomed to really reflect a little bit on specifically how that assignment affected their views on who does science and who scientists are. Most commonly, these are done as homework assignments for participation credit or word count credit and timeliness. And so it's not like something that's really deeply graded or that constitutes a huge amount of points in the class or anything of that sort. quite often then those scientific resources are brought into class in some way. And so, you know, the next class, maybe we would start that lecture on muscle physiology with that scientist's work and somehow talk about like, okay, we're going to go back to, you know, this scientist's efforts and what they did and really dig a little bit more into their research. And then the lecture or the class activities or whatever might be partially based on that as well. Yeah, I think that that's mostly like the sort of structural background of what a scientist spotlight would be and what is now available nationally and globally through through our website.
Right. So there is a website and we will provide the link to that on our website and also at the end of this session. So who picks the scientists that are spotlighted in your course?
Yeah, so that I think that's really important. And of course, going back to that first time that I did that early version of a scientist spotlight with that podcast, I was picking that person. And I'll say that summer, I was so compelled by my students really telling me from their own perspectives, hey, we need this, we want this, that I went away and I developed weekly scientist spotlights for my class because I was just so excited that my students wanted more of this that I decided that I really wanted to do this regularly. And again, I picked the scientists. I tried to really think as carefully as I could about the identities in my classroom. And I have some evidence on that. I collect evidence and gather it also from institutional resources about who's in my class. And so I know a little bit about the various identities that are in my classroom. And I tried to think about those different axes of diversity and really purposefully choose scientists that I thought would feature many different axes of diversity with the hope that there would be one or hopefully multiple scientists that every student could potentially could engage with and relate to. But as the project progressed, and this is one of the lovely aspects of the evolution of the project, and especially when we now have NIH support to do this grant work, is that we realized that folks like me are probably not in the best position to decide who should get featured in the curricula in terms of which scientists and what identities they represent. The students themselves should. The students should be the ones. And so one of the most exciting parts about the project and this NIH project that is now called the Scientist Spotlights Initiative was the development of service learning courses at so far two institutions, my own institution at Foothill College and San Francisco State University, where biology students get, or any students who want to enroll, I guess, get course credit. And they'll get, you know, in my institution, 4 units of course credit to take a course where they study lots of things like that literature on stereotype threat that I was first engaged with, literature on implicit bias and identity and many, many other areas. And we read papers and have journal clubs and all that kind of stuff. But the service learning component of those courses is that students author scientist spotlights and they think deeply about the courses they've taken, which parts of the curricula in those courses they maybe struggled with or wish they could have related to more, and then go out and look for scientists that they can personally relate to and that they would be excited to study around that curriculum. And then they develop the scientist spotlight assignment itself. And now on our website, when we have over 400 spotlights there in a variety of fields, going from cell molecular biology and physics and math to everything like gender studies and ethnic studies. There's just a really amazing breadth of topics on there now. Mm-hmm. And they all, almost all of them now, the ones that have been developed through the initiative, have a little biography at the bottom of the student that developed them with a picture of that student and why that student chose that scientist to feature. That's been really cool because, for one thing, we're much more authentically bringing students into curriculum development and handing over control of the curriculum to students. But for another thing, it's almost like a mini scientist spotlight within the spotlight, because now, like, you know, not only are we featuring the scientist that student chose to feature, but we're actually featuring the student themselves too. And that's another near peer person that students doing their homework assignment can now relate to that person too. So that's been really fun.
Yeah, I love that. I'm looking at your website right now. For anybody listening, it is scientistspotlights.org. So easy to find. So I really like the thought and depth that went into having students identify the scientists. It wasn't just, oh, go out and find a scientist in the middle of this intro biology class, go out and find somebody and do something. Because you send students out there untrained in what they really need to do, and you've developed, in fact, a rich course environment designed specifically for this development of this unit. That's a very thoughtful and very intentional approach to getting the student voices in, but getting it in a way that is very mature. I mean, so that they can bring a very mature perspective to the issue. Not that they're immature students, but just that they need some perspective on what this is all about and how to do it, so that you bring forward a really thoughtful piece.
Yeah, and many of the students who are in that class were previously in classes where scientist spotlights were used by their instructor. And it's really fun where and of course, then they sign up for the class because those assignments resonated with them. And so they're excited to contribute. But it's really fun when they, like you say, get the more in-depth, I guess, scholarly perspective on why they like them. It's almost like they understand at a deeper level why they like the assignments when they were doing them in class. And so there's lots of great epiphanies during those classes in the service learning course where students are like, oh, that totally makes sense. Like, this is exactly why, you know, doing these assignments was so impactful for me. It was because of, you know, these issues of, you know, stereotype threat and stereotypes and belonging and identity and all these things. And so absolutely, it's really exciting to see those epiphanies come up. I just have to give so much credit to my collaborators because as this project is going on 8 or 9 years now, it's become a huge group of people who've contributed. And so my colleagues at the Scientist Spotlights Initiative were some of the ones who helped me even to see the importance of this. And so I'm only saying that because I'm here to represent a really large group of amazing scholars and thoughtful educators who have contributed to this now over so many years. And many of them helped me realize the importance of exactly what you were talking about.
So now that you're building this catalog of spotlights and you come to a topic, so I'm looking, for example, at muscle systems, you've got 5 scientists on there currently. When there are options, do you still assign a single person or do you let students then pick? Do you say, hey, why don't you go to the spotlight and pick one of these and do a piece? How do you use it?
I personally actually assign the spotlights specifically as, you know, go and like work on this one scientist spotlight. And that's mm-hmm. always how I've done it in my classes. But I have multiple colleagues who do it differently. And, you know, my main collaborator and co-PI on the project, Kimberly Tanner, has always done more so what you were discussing, where each time they do a scientist spotlight assignment, there's 2 or 3 possibilities. And so it's like, you know, here are 2 or 3 scientists, choose one of them for this. And you only have to do one, choose one of them and, you know, write your reflective essay on what you learned about that person and their work. And I think that's lovely too. And I think that's also especially lovely way to make sure that more identities are acknowledged and honored during it if you're not, you know, doing these every single week. And further, like some of the follow-up studies we've done have shown that doing these every week like I did, so I, you know, I'm in the quarter system, so we do like 10 of them for once every week. I don't think there's any evidence saying that you have to do 10 scientist spotlights to get an impactful outcome out of that activity. And so it can be nice to reduce that a bit and do, you know, maybe 3 or 4 during the quarter, 2 or 3 even during the quarter or during the semester. In those cases, though, that means that like, well, okay, at that point, you're only choosing like 2 or 3 scientists to feature. And it starts I think for some instructors, it starts to feel very high stakes. Like, you know, oh, well, but if I choose that person, then I'm not like, you know, honoring this other identity. Or if I choose that person, then I'm not honoring this other identity. Right. And so when you have 10 shots at it, so to say, like, you know, you can honor a lot of, I think, and acknowledge a lot of different diversity and identities. If you only have 2 or 3 tries at it over a term, then it starts to feel a little bit higher stakes who you actually choose to feature and implicitly who you don't choose to feature. And so I think that that's where, you know, having some choice is maybe mm-hmm. even especially better, because then you can have 3 choices for each of those 2 scientist spotlights you do, and then students can hopefully gravitate towards the individuals that they're most excited about seeing featured.
Right. So you've mentioned 2 implementations, yours, which you pick one every week for your quarter, yeah. And Kimberly's, when she does a scientist spotlight, she gives them some options. But there are many other people involved in this initiative. What are other models of utilizing the scientist spotlight initiative? How else are they being used that you're aware of?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Not only are there other individuals on my team, and of course nationwide, who are not even on the team using them now, but in the last couple of years, we've been working really closely with high school teachers. And so we've been moving into the secondary science education realm as well. And across all those contexts, from, you know, research universities to community colleges to liberal arts mm-hmm. colleges to military academies, I was just at U.S. Air Force Academy talking with them about this, to high schools that are, you know, big high schools, small high schools, and all different geographies and demographics of students in those places, you certainly get a wide variety of implementation. I think that a big question that we have right now is, to what extent is fidelity of implementation or what are the important parts of fidelity of implementation that lead mm-hmm. to the most sort of striking outcomes? And that's something that we're trying to figure out from a research standpoint. And we're just starting to get some clues on that. I think that certainly the number of spotlights varies dramatically. I mean, we have people who come upon the website or, you know, see one of us at a workshop or something, and they think, oh, this is cool. You know, I'll just try one of them. And that's not unlike what I did when I was first trying out that first time I did the early scientist spotlight. And even that was quite impactful and really inspired me to do more. And so that's where in the professional development we do, I feel like we sort of have this secret strategy, which is like, hey, what would it hurt to try one? Because it's pretty easy. It doesn't take any grading time, doesn't take class time, all this stuff if you do it outside of class and is homework. And we sort of in the back of our minds know, oh, you know what's going to happen is your students are going to really kind of respond dramatically to these. And then you're going to be inspired to do more because there's nothing, I think, more inspiring to a teacher than having their students really call for more, more of what they're teaching. So one, I mean, we have people just doing, you know, one or two, people doing them every week like me. We have lots of different strategies in terms of how they get incorporated into class or not. There's some people who do these strictly as out-of-class assignments, and then they're virtually never mentioned in class in any way. It's just like, okay, that's homework, and then it never gets acknowledged much in class. We have folks who build entire weeks of curriculum around them, and I have some examples of that even in my own classes where a particular resource from a scientist is just so beautifully connected to my curriculum that I can plan an entire week of activities for my students to work on and collaborate on and lecture around their research or something. And so I think that there's huge variation in the extent to which it is really brought into class and used in class in the curriculum versus used out of class in the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And then I think another thing that we're really curious about in addition to that is the reasons that people use them and the extent to which instructors convey those reasons to their students. This is another completely separate area of my research and that I've published on, but instructor talk is, you know, this non-content language that instructors use in front of classes, in front of groups of students. We suspect, we hypothesize that that's behind a lot of the differential outcomes for a lot of active learning strategies and a lot of different things that are done in the classroom is the way that those strategies are discussed and implemented in terms of the instructor talk. And so I think that we're increasingly really curious about the ways that different teachers and instructors are discussing these with their students, if at all, and then the way that that might relate to different outcomes.
Cool. Very cool. Instructor talk. So Kimberly was episode number 2 of the podcast where we introduced instructor talk. And I have there's another episode coming up with Mallory Rice and Dax Ovid.
Yes. Yes. All leaders on instructor talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a topic I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You raised the issue of data and impact. So can you tell us about some of the research outcomes that you've had and the impact on students' persistence or success, whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. You think about that follow-up term or that follow-up quarter where I was now doing them every week and I was still seeing, you know, just these amazing and exciting to read responses. I start to get excited about grading homework, which is like pretty unusual. It's like, I can't wait to grade homework because I just can't wait to see what my students are saying. And so as I was experiencing all that, I, of course, and especially having had a bit of a background in education research, I was like, okay, I want to know more systematically what's going on because anecdotally, I'm seeing what seems to be really dramatic outcomes from these assignments, and I want to be more systematic about it and really understand the depth of that or what's happening with my students here. I was really lucky to partner up with a couple psychologists who study stereotypes. And so Mary Weyer at North Carolina State and then Heather Perkins, who's currently at Purdue, are experts in scientist stereotypes. And I became aware, of course, that there's a many decades old literature around scientist stereotypes. And I figured, okay, this seems like a fruitful place to start. This seems like a promising place. Given what I'm seeing in my students' responses, I think that looking at effects on stereotypes would be a great place to begin. We also decided that we wanted to, you know, look more specifically at student identities and maybe use the lens of something that at that time was new to me, which is possible selves. So it's sort of related to the idea of role modeling, but it's a slightly different construct than just thinking about role models. And really thinking about people that students themselves could see themselves becoming in the future and why they find that relatability to those individuals. And so those were the two first sort of outcomes that we wanted to look at was, do these assignments shift students in terms of their scientist stereotypes, and do they shift students' ideas about their possible selves or relatability to scientists? And we conducted some studies that involved a group doing scientist spotlights every week, and then a comparison group that was doing very similar assignments, just without the biographical information. So they still did the homework that was based on the scientific resource, just not with the biographical information. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the results that we were seeing anecdotally, found very, very clear signals of controlling for as much as we could in terms of like differences between groups and all this kind of stuff. We found very clear signals that the scientist spotlight as an intervention was shifting quite dramatically students' ideas about scientists and who they were and scientist stereotypes in lots of dramatic and really fascinating ways, in some ways that we didn't even fully expect. And then also that students were, again, dramatically changing their opinions about whether they could personally relate to who scientists were and specific scientists even. And so we found that really, really exciting. Of course, in consideration of the stereotype threat work that I had looked at, I was also curious, well, will this have an effect potentially on learning? Will doing these out-of-class assignments have some effect on students' then ability to actually then take in things like, again, mitosis, muscle physiology, ecology, whatever it is, in class? So we looked at exam scores and course grades for that, because, of course, the scientist spotlight assignments were a very small portion of the course grade. The majority of the course grade was based on things like, lab write-ups and lab practicals and exams and other sorts of activities that were purely based around the content. I frankly thought, oh my goodness, grades and even learning, these are such messy variables in some ways, and there's so much that goes into grades. Like, I'm just not sure what we can learn from that. And further, these assignments seem, even though I think they're impactful, I'm not sure that they're really going to transfer to learning more about muscle physiology. I don't know about that. And so I was quite skeptical. As is often the case in science, I turned out to be wrong, but we actually found, again, controlling for as many variables as we could, we found that students were achieving higher grades in the classes that where scientist spotlights were done compared to the comparison group. As best as we could tell, we're actually learning more biology in those classes because that's what those grades were largely based on. And so that, as surprising as it was to me, aligned very well with the background literature on stereotype threat, which finds very, very similar results. If these socio-emotional issues are attended to, that people learn better and that they take in more information. Even though I think all that was out there already, I think it was still surprising to me to see that effect. That was really exciting. That first paper came out in 2016. And of course, what's always exciting about the process of science is that, the years go by and other people start going around and trying things themselves. And so it's been just a real pleasure to see so many folks out there who are not even part of my research team, who I don't have any direct connections to myself, going out and saying, well, I don't know, would that work here? Jeff did that at Foothill Community College with this, incredibly diverse, community college population on the West Coast in an urban area of California. How's that going to work at a research university that's a predominantly white institution? So Jonas and Sohia Kotner and colleagues went out and tried this in University of Minnesota. It's been tried in now so many different contexts. I couldn't even name all the papers, I think, right away. San Francisco State, also very different from Foothill College, but similarly finding many of these exact same things, that we still get these dramatic shifts in these main variables that we saw even at Foothill College. So that's been really fascinating and exciting.
That's incredible. And the awesome thing about that is, of course, you're teaching students in their first and second year courses. You're doing these early courses, and we know that the loss of students in early courses, the lack of persistence, disproportionately affects our historically minoritized and excluded students. So if you lose students at that early stage, what you're losing largely is a lot of your diversity in your courses. It's a less diverse class that moves forward. So let's ask specifically about that. Have you looked at this measure, the opportunity gap in your courses? We've talked about this gap before, but the gap between how majority students do compared to minoritized students, and that can be broken up in any number of ways. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been really interested in this question of disaggregating the data on a variety of different axes, I think, for a long time. It's something that we've never published on. I guess there's sort of two sets of findings that we've had. And again, if you look not just at the Foothill College data, but at the others that I'm aware of, especially the San Francisco State data. One finding, in some of these variables, we actually don't see a disproportionate impact. That we see, it seems to be a similar level of impact on students from many different groups, depending on how you divide up and disaggregate the population. And the other is that there's maybe seems to be a signal or the potential for some slight disproportionate impact for students from underserved groups or minoritized groups, but not necessarily, you know, statistically significant, perhaps, or at least not yet. I'll say the times that we see that disproportionate impact, the signal is because the pretest, like the beginning of class measures for the student from minoritized groups tends to be at a, I don't know what you'd say, like, I don't like saying lower level because that makes it seem like it's a deficit or something, but like the data would indicate that the students from minoritized backgrounds have not had as much of an opportunity coming into class to identify with scientists as the students from the dominant culture backgrounds. And so like they will report lower levels of relatability or lower levels of non-stereotypical ideas or higher levels of stereotypical ideas. They seem to start at a slightly farther away place, I guess, than the dominant culture students. And then at the end of class, they seem to be very similar. So the impact seems to be that there's a different baseline, essentially. There's a different baseline for the dominant culture students compared to the minoritized students. And that then they seem to come up to a similar place at the end of class in terms of things like the stereotypes that they report or their level of relatability. But again, that's been something that's been so close to something that we could have reported, but just it's never quite made it into a paper because we can't fully, you know, separate from random chance yet, statistically. And then in other places, it seems to be that there really has not been even a detectable trend for differential impacts. In some ways, I think that can be framed as quite a hopeful finding or humbling, depending on how you think about it. I think that the humbling side of it is that even students that we might perceive to come from dominant culture backgrounds have not had opportunities to see science humanized. And I think that there's a deeper issue that the culture of science is not traditionally or stereotypically prone to humanization. In fact, we do a lot of things and we say a lot of things in science that are almost against humanization. Like the stereotype is that science is objective and that science is not based on your own ideas or who you are or something, right? And that, you know, who does science is objective. And there's this myth, I would say, of objectivity in science. And it is absolutely a myth. Science is very subjective. Science is very much based on the identities and biases and stereotypes that we all bring to this field and to our work. And it has everything to do with the questions that we ask and the questions we don't ask and the treatment of our data and the conclusions that we reach and all of these things. But even though that's the case, the stereotype is certainly that science is this very objective place where there's not an attention really necessarily to the humans who do it. It turns out that's not helpful for anyone. That's not helpful for white men who have scientist parents and who have a deep background in science, right? Like I think that the social scientists would roll their eyes because, of course, this is just obviously true that humanization is important in any field. And so I think that that's where I say in these cases where we don't necessarily see a strong disproportionate impact for certain groups of students, I think that the humbling message is that, oh my goodness, like we've just been disservicing everyone in some ways by not humanizing our fields.
Right.
The hopeful message is that these types of interventions are deeply valued by all sorts of students and are deeply needed by all sorts of students, not just for people, you know, I don't know, you could say people like me or something like, oh, you work in a community college, like so that's really important for you. You know, I work at this other institution where my students are very different. And so like, it's not as important for me. Well, I don't think that that's what either the data nor common sense show, like that even for your students, whoever those mythical students are that you're teaching, this is still deeply, deeply important for them too.
So the data do show, however, as you said, that it improves student performance. So students are going to do better. So you have fewer lower grades, you have more students succeeding in your courses. And that's what we're all here for. We're all here for student success, right? So this is something that can be implemented in courses that improve student success. And I just want to make this point. It's on your website, and you've alluded to it, that it also can be discipline agnostic. It is scientist spotlights that you've developed, but you do have, as you said, fields on your website, I'm looking right now, in gender studies, in linguistics, citizen science, environmental justice.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, for one thing, there are no way STEM spotlights, not just scientist spotlights. I think that we could, that doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well. But I think our intention was always to be of service to the STEM community broadly.
Sure.
And in many places, like, you know, psychology is part of STEM, right? And so STEM, I think STEM can be very broadly interpreted, and gender studies could be part of STEM maybe even. And so I think that we want to be very inclusive of what we consider STEM in terms of who and what topics are featured on Scientist Spotlights. But yeah, I think even things that you really wouldn't even associate with STEM, I think that this is important. So, like, I've had fascinating conversations, for example, with language arts colleagues or English colleagues, English faculty, right, about this. And it's been really, really interesting. So we'll, mm-hmm, things will come up where, like, they'll say, oh yeah, you know, in this writing class, we always look at texts that are about social justice or something. And they'll say, well, that's fantastic. That's really great. But do you feature the authors of those texts and talk about who they were and why they did their work? And like, in a way, you know, if you're in a writing class, you want people to identify with writers, like, not just with what they're reading. And there's almost like this subtle difference there where, and like, kind of a light bulb goes off. You're like, well, you talk a little bit about them, but I guess not really, or something. And some people do, absolutely. Like, you talk deeply about the authors, but there's even possibility in fields that are really well outside of STEM for things like, you know, author spotlights, perhaps, where it's like, yes, we read this person's work, but do we ever really delve at all into what lived experiences led them to write like that? Or maybe even more importantly, what lived experiences led them to want to be a writer? Not just to have that as their, as this topic of their novel or their article or whatever they wrote, but what led them to want to write and to pursue this field? Because I think that I would propose that students in a writing class might find it very outlandish to consider themselves as writers, or like, you know, I could be a writer, like, this could be a field that I could engage with, and like, right, I might be a writer person. And so I think that, again, that's just one example where, absolutely, I think that we can have really lovely interdisciplinary conversations about how this looks in other fields, even well beyond STEM.
And that's why I raised the issue. My podcast, although I'm a scientist, you're a scientist, my podcast is, I want it to be discipline agnostic. I want the sorts of things we talk about, and I think the things we talk about can be applied to any academic discipline and to life outside. There's lots of examples of that.
Yeah.
I want people to think about that so that while we're talking about a specific program and project and limitation to sort of an area, let's say STEM, but sure, historians, political scientists, language arts, any field could really think about this as a way to improve the environment, the learning environment for students, and to help, as you just said, to help their students, our students, your students, see themselves as professionals in that field, not just analyzing a book, but becoming an author or a critic or whatever, right? Or an academic, right? So I think that's a really interesting idea.
And I think that, I mean, I do want to acknowledge that there are some major differences in the cultures of the different disciplines. And so, like, what applies for biology does not even necessarily apply to mathematics, much less, you know, gender studies or something. But I do think that humanizing ourselves in our professional and academic lives and, mm-hmm, humanizing our fields in our professional and academic lives is somewhat universal. And so, and I would say that some of these other fields have some similar challenges with that as STEM does. Like, it's not only STEM that is prone to accidentally or purposefully not humanizing our field, not humanizing those individuals. And so I've seen that same issue arise in many other fields where, again, this can be really beneficial and helpful.
Okay, so let me pose a scenario. Let's say a student starts at Foothill Community College, has your course, and then transfers to an institution to complete their four-year degree. What if this other institution hasn't heard of this initiative or hasn't even considered these issues? How do students fare when they suddenly find themselves in a potentially less nurturing environment?
I mean, I think that that's a multi-million dollar question that a lot of people and funding agencies are trying to answer. And it is a big question. I mean, so there's a lot of researchers currently working on transfer shock or like, you know, other sorts of transfer sort of issues, because nationwide there is a tendency for transfer students to maybe not succeed at the same rate as students who started at a university as a freshman themselves. I'll say in California, that's actually not the case. So you and I, we may have a different story. Like, I've always been surprised that I feel like the universities here in California are just almost fighting over my students and over community college students. I remember I went to a talk on this at UC Davis recently, where they just showed really compelling data that the transfer students were far outperforming their folks who started there as freshmen. And so they're just desperate for more transfer students. But I do think that it is a broader issue and something that is really tricky because I think it's a lot of things. I think that it's probably not just scientist spotlights or the lack thereof that contribute to those feelings in those places. I think there's many cultural issues, geographic issues, pedagogical issues, so many things that contribute to that. And I think that that's why it's such a hard for many institutions to put their finger on, is like, what are these problems with our institution? Not with the students, I hope. Let's not problematize the students. But what are the problems with the institution that we can solve to make this more welcoming? One thing that's not universal, but quite common among scientist spotlight assignments, though, is that the scientists in their biographical information are talking about the struggles that they went through. That is often really empowering. I've had people ask me the question, like, oh my gosh, like, I've read some examples, and is this just depressing to students? Like, you know, is it depressing to students to hear about that these people from all these backgrounds encountered so many challenges, and that, like, these challenges exist today? Like, does this actually discourage people? Does this people make some students want to, like, leave or something? And I say, absolutely not. I understand that concern, and I was worried about that too to some extent. But it is life reaffirming for students, because we don't need to, like, worry that students will discover that life is hard for them. We don't have to worry that my Latino veteran students who are coming back with families, that they're going to suddenly discover, because I give them a science spotlight, they're going to discover that, like, some things are stacked against them. Like, give me a break. They are quite aware that many things in the world are stacked against them. They're not waiting for me to reveal that to them, and then they're going to be horrified and leave. Quite the opposite. When in a classroom environment, and maybe especially a science classroom environment, when those challenges are acknowledged and honored, that is relieving to students. In their writing, you can see the sense of relief. Oh my gosh, it's so good to see people talking about this. Like, this is so true. Like, I've kind of had that happen to me too. Or like, wow, I haven't even had it as bad as that, but I can see this going on. And it's nice to be able to put a name to this thing that's going on, and to be able to see that other people are going through this and have made it. It's a huge sigh of relief in many ways. And I say that to answer your question, because I think that that sigh of relief is helpful. I would hope that that sigh of relief is helpful. You know, this is happening to me. I'm experiencing these challenges in this new context now, in this university context. But I've heard of this before. It's not only me. I know I'm not alone, because I've read about this and I've heard a compelling story about this, and I know lots of other people are with me on this. And it's not going to be easy, but other people have done it, and I might be able to do it too, and I'm not alone.
So it becomes inspirational.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Two more questions. How has the Scientist Spotlights initiative impacted you outside of academia? So when you're out at baseball practice with your sons, or you're at the grocery store, when you're sitting at a traffic light, or in a coffee shop, or in a movie. I don't want to hear about academics. I mean, how has it impacted your life in other ways?
I think that I guess I can't attribute it all to Scientist Spotlights, but I can attribute a lot of it to Scientist Spotlights, is just becoming more comfortable with my own identities and what they are, and my positionality in the different spaces I occupy, whether that's as a professor, or whether that's as a dad, or whether that's as somebody on a field trip with my kids. I think that I've become just really comfortable trying to reflect on my positioning in the various contexts and the various spaces I occupy, and understanding the impacts that my identities have in those spaces. And so it gets back to, like, again, that first question I asked myself of, like, well, what does it mean for my students if I'm the only scientist in this classroom that is featured? And I think that I've become aware of that now, and just not in my classroom spaces, but other spaces as well. And that's been really interesting and helpful, and sometimes humbling, and sometimes depressing, and then sometimes really exciting. And so, but I think that it's really important in the spirit of cultural humility to be able to reflect on who we are, and that changes over time, and how who we are changes, and how those identities impact us and the people around us. And then the second thing that is, I think, been really important, that has been really quite more directly inspired by Scientist Spotlights, is being more clear about humanizing myself, especially in teaching, but in all spaces. And so I think that I've become much more comfortable with just being very clear about what my identities are and what hidden identities I have that are not apparent. I just to give one example, including in teaching, but also outside of teaching, I've just become much more comfortable sharing that of my whole life I've had anxiety and panic disorders, and that's something that's really deeply impacted me in my professional life, in my academic life, and of course in my personal life. I realized that sharing things like that in many different spaces is important because it builds that sense of comfort and relatability. And it's a piece of me that people don't see. It's not like a surface level feature of me that people can perceive and pick up on. It builds relationships in a lot of ways. Barriers are broken down by sharing things like that. And I have other colleagues that in the education research community who actually study this, who, like, you know, for example, study, you know, what it means to come out as LGBTQ plus in class or with their colleagues or something. And I don't have that identity myself to share, but that plus the Scientist Spotlights work, I think, has made me much more open and realize how important, not just open, but how important it is to actually try to be okay being vulnerable and try to be okay with expressing pieces of my identity that might be really important for some people to hear in ways that I don't even know that it's important for them to hear.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Appreciate that. Okay, so now let's come back to that question about your positionality in the classroom. So you said, you know, at the beginning, you wonder whether you should even be there. So it sounds like the Scientist Spotlight must provide you with a perspective that you have a place in front of the classroom, that you do belong there. But maybe I'm wrong. How do you feel about it?
That's a really difficult question to answer, except to say I've come to decide that the day that I stop asking myself that question is probably when I should retire and not do this work anymore. And so I think it's really important that I, maybe for other people too, but I'll just speak for myself. I think it's really important that I continue to question and critique myself on that. There are limitations to my impacts on students because of some of my identities that they don't share. There are some things that I will never be able to do for students because of that, that I cannot serve that role for them. I cannot play that part for them. And it would be wrong of me to assume that I could. I think that some of those are pretty important roles to play. And so that continues to give me pause. And it's something that, I don't know if it's on a daily basis, but on a frequent basis, I'm worried about.
Interesting. Thank you. It's making me think about when I was at Chico State for a few years. When I got there, the outgoing president, I think his philosophy, something that they said about him that he had said previously was, the students that we get are the students that we have. It was something like that. That's poorly said. But the students that we accept into college are your students, and it is your job to do your best with them and to help them succeed. That's the job. It's not the students you want. It's the students you get. And hopefully you want the students you get. I mean, but I'm sort of thinking about the faculty. I'm thinking about turning that onto being a faculty member is whether you think you should be or whether I thought I should be or whoever other listeners think they should be, they are the person in the classroom. So you are there. So it is now your responsibility. You've taken on this job. You've taken on the responsibility of being that person in front of them. And at the moment, this is the option they have. It's you or it's you. There is no option. I mean, there's an option if you retire, but then it's the next person, right? But the person in front of the class is one person. Okay. Maybe it's a team talk class, but it's one person. And then that's the way it's going to be. So it's your responsibility to do your best in front of them. And I suspect your questioning keeps you challenging yourself to at least be the best you can be for your students. So that at the end, so that when you do leave the job, which eventually you will, one way or another, that you can look back and know that you've been thoughtful about your students and you've cared about them and you've done the best you could do at the time you did it with who you are and your all of our imperfections and limitations and our expertises and perfections, right?
Absolutely. I agree, and I think that the type of reflection and questioning that I'm talking about that I do regularly is really aimed at exactly that, at trying to make sure right. that I'm serving my students in that way.
Right. Okay, so last question. I'd like to hear your transformation story. Why did you become an academic, or what motivated you to become an education researcher? Why did this become so important to you? What happened?
I've always had a couple of the passions that you mentioned earlier. So I've been a musician for a long time, and I've been really interested in science and in particular in fish for a long time. So my training is in marine biology and marine fish evolution. So I had fish tanks going back to, you know, middle school and earlier, and was always fascinated and wanted to learn everything about them. And so I think that those passions were both there. I think that the other thing that's been in the background for me is teaching. And so I, I don't know if they've yet found the gene for teaching, but if there is one, it strangely seems to run in my family. And so from my grandparents to, you know, uncles and aunts to mother to sister to on and on, there's just teachers all over the place. And so I've always had a deep appreciation for teaching. And so coming out of an undergrad and going into grad school, I suspected that I wanted to do teaching in some way. I was in grad school taking graduate seminars in teaching and learning and to some extent education research, and considering my options. As I was thinking about it, I was knowing that I really still want to be a science person too. I love collecting evidence and trying to make decisions based on evidence. And so I had this bit of a dilemma in the middle of grad school thinking about, well, how am I going to do this? Like if I'm really in a primarily teaching position, which is what I really wanted to aim for, I thought, how am I going to still scratch this itch of, you know, doing science, of being a science person? It was in those graduate seminars where I first was introduced to education research. And I think I'd, you know, of course, vaguely known that it existed before, but the examples that I encountered there resonated with me. It felt like, oh my gosh, these people doing education research are doing exactly what I like to do in terms of being a scientist, but they're not working on fish. they're working on people, and they seem to be getting some really fascinating results using some of the same strategies that you could even use with fish in various ways. Some of the same analytical mindsets or strategies, at least, that are immediately applicable to teaching and learning, which is, of course, what I was passionate about. And so I think a lot of things clicked right then. And I was like, okay, this could be it. Like, this could be what really works for me. Is like, I can be primarily an educator. I can really have my professional life built around teaching. But I can continue to be a scientist by doing this education research. Since getting involved in those things and being able to get grants and build collaborations, it's just been a really lovely community to be a part of. I feel like back then and even now, biology education research is still a relatively newish community, it seems, still kind of a small community in some ways, even though it's growing bigger and bigger. And so it felt very nurturing back then when I was kind of trying to get into it. And I was lucky to just encounter some amazing collaborators and mentors. That's really led me to what I do now, which is to be able to work with, again, just the most amazing students in the world day in and day out in my classes, and then to satisfy my scientific mindset and scientific curiosity through education research. And it's been wonderful.
Great. Thank you. Jeff, I'd like to thank you so much for the time you spent with me today. It's been a great discussion, really enlightening. I've enjoyed our time together. I hope this podcast motivates my listeners to check out your website and to try out the ideas. Introduce scientists into your courses and humanize it, more importantly. Jeff, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks. It's been really fun. I've had a lot of fun. So thank you for all your questions and ideas.
In addition to this podcast, our website, teachingforstudentsuccess.org, will provide additional information about Jeff and the Scientist Spotlights Initiative. Thank you for spending time with us today. Please share our podcast and website with your friends. Thank you for caring about your teaching and your students. Again, the army of education researchers out there, I think Jeff said enough today. Thank you for everything you do. It's so important. Those of us at Teaching for Student Success would love your feedback. Please contact us through our website at teachingforstudentsuccess.org. Teaching for Student Success is a production of Teaching for Student Success Media. Let's end this podcast as we always do with some music by Julius H. Some of Julius's music can be found on Pixabay.